obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Sherry, alcoholic. Sober since May 29th, 1988. I'm very, very grateful for that. That means, for those of you who aren't good at math, if I was here next year, I would be in your long-timers group, unless you change it to 30, which I heard sometimes folks do. Anyway, I'm very, very grateful to be here, and I want to thank Lars Seen, one of my very, very favorite Al-Anon people on the planet, and the committee for inviting me and for allowing me to bring a guest. That means a lot to me. You know, we all have somebody in our life who is the person who stays home and watches the kid and takes care of the cats and does all of that so that we can come and travel and do things. And it's really great when we can bring them with us and allow them to come to the conference. So I really appreciate you doing that. It was very kind of you. Chris and Beverly, who have been great hosts, and Betty, my friend, who was the fill-in host yesterday and did a great job. And it's just been great. If you missed any of the meetings yesterday, you really missed it. You know, you got to hit Danny Gable, knockout talk. I mean, it's just been an amazing conference. And then he played. I mean, it was just incredible. And the long-timers meeting and the old-timers meeting and the Al-Anon lunch, I mean, it's just been awesome. So thank you. And if you got to all of those things, then the heat's off because you've already had a really great conference and you don't have to care about what I have to say. I also, just on a little personal note, a person who saved my life, and you'll hear about that in a minute, but June is celebrating 40 years in AA in a couple of weeks, and it's so great that I was able to come out here and at least wish her a happy, you know, we'll have to hold her to it. She'll have to stay sober for two more weeks, but it was really great to get to see her this close to her, to a major anniversary for her. So thank you. Thank you very much. I grew up in an alcoholic family, which I know isn't unusual, but it does explain a few things. My father died when I was very young, and my mother remarried, and the man she married was an alcoholic, and he had these kids who would sort of come one at a time. There was all this chaos. I never was quite sure who was there. I remember when I was very young declaring that if I was not blood related to you, I wasn't claiming you, and nobody cared, but it seemed important to me to take a stand. And I had, from the earliest time that I can remember with that man and those kids and all that mess, just my biggest strategy was just to try to be invisible. Just like my first life skill was just try to fade into the wall, just not be the one that gets noticed. And there was a lot of violence, a lot of people getting hit. My brother, stepbrother and I were the ones most often in line for that. And I just didn't want to, you know, I just wanted to try to avoid that any way I could. And I learned really early on to just avoid that house altogether. I was telling Larsine earlier, I at one point went to Al-Anon, and I said to a friend of mine who's in Al-Anon, I said, went to Al-Anon, and she wasn't shocked, which I thought she would be. She said, well, you grew up in an alcoholic home. I said, yeah, I know, but they didn't affect me. She said, well, what makes you think that? I said, well, I wasn't there. And she said, well, where were you? And I said, well, I was out on the streets. She said, I think that might be an effect of alcoholism. I sort of missed that, you know, but anyway, so when I was fairly young, I had my first drink, and it was just, it was that magic thing. It just kind of went, you know, it just went, and it was like I went from being the scared, try to be invisible, try to fade into the woodwork, to being like, I'm in here, and I'm in your face, and I'm going to get what I want, and I'm going to do what I want, and if you don't like it, too bad. My first year drinking, I slugged a teacher. I broke my arm in a fight with a kid next door. I mean, it was really off to kind of a quick start here. I loved it. It just seemed like it solved everything for me. And when you're very underage, it's kind of hard. Oh. Okay. Please move the microphone. Okay, so is that better? Can you hear me now? Okay, hi. Sherry, alcoholic. Oh, no, sorry. And I just went, I just like completely changed. And I loved drinking. It just seemed like the solution to everything to me. And it's like somebody said, when it does that much for you, it takes a long time to see what it's doing to you. And it certainly did. And I just started running the streets and, you know, as I said, getting in fights and doing what I wanted to do. And I had this weird sort of combination of things, because there was this woman in my neighborhood named Al. It turned out, I found out later, Al failed her driver's test 3 times, so nobody but me would get in a car with her. But I would get in the car with anybody who would take me somewhere, and she'd just drive. I was easy to find. I was outside. She would drive around. She'd find me, and she'd go, "Hey, you want to go?" And I'd go. And we went to Cleaners, and we went to the, you know, all these places, the grocery store, you know, boring stuff. And one day she took me to a library. And, you know, I can still smell the smell of those books in that library. Because I was this kid that once I learned to read, I read everything. I read to the annoyance of everyone around me. Some of it I read out loud. I read the cereal box, the ketchup bottle, the billboards going by. I read everything. I loved to read. I just read everything. And she took me to this library, and I'm like pestering her, going, "What is this place? Where are we? What is this?" And finally she told me you could take out books for free and just read them. I mean, for free. I couldn't believe it. I still can't believe it. I still love libraries. And so I asked him how many books. I made her get me a library card. I asked her how many. I made her, like a little kid can make somebody do something. But my sponsor told me once I wasn't really that good at conning people. Sometimes people just want to do nice things. But anyway, she got me a library card, and I checked. You could take 10 books. And I went over to that first shelf of the first stack, and I counted off 10 books, and I read them, and I brought them back, and I counted off 10 more, and she brought me back every 2 weeks, and every 2 weeks I counted off 10 more books, and I read every book in the Maricopa County Children's Library. And then I went to the adult library and counted off 10. They wouldn't let me have them, which I thought was really crummy. I thought if you read all the other ones, you ought to get to read those. So I'm reading all these books, and I'm running the streets and getting in fights and stealing, and it didn't seem odd to me to be doing both of those things. It was just, that was how I was living. And I had this thing, you know, where, you know, if you had something I wanted, I just took it. Even if sometimes I didn't want it, I'd just take it anyway. I just once stole 126 turn signal levers. I don't know why, you know, just they were there. It occurs to me that this is close enough that some of you may be from Arizona, and if you are older than me and you were missing a turn signal lever, you want to see me after the meeting, I'll make that right. When I first got sober, I told people I was a thief. You know, I was really a petty thief. I mean, that's just kind of embarrassing. I've never even stole an actual whole car. I did, however, steal enough parts that I probably could have traded them all in for a car, but I didn't. So anyway, so I'm doing all this stuff. And in the middle of all of this dropped somebody who I think was just an angel. And she was a teacher. And I was this kid. I had deals when I was in school, especially when I was in high school. They didn't want a kid like me in their class because I caused too much trouble. And so they'd make deals, you know, just don't come to class. Just pick up the work, drop it off, you know, and we'll let you get by with that. And one of the people who made that deal was my English teacher, Mr. Nelson. And Mr. Nelson said, you know, just you cause too much trouble. Just come get the work, do the work, turn it in, and I'll pass you. And I thought that was great. But if you're cool like me, you have to come into class in the middle of the class. So everybody knows you're way too cool to have to sit in the class. And you got to strut in so everybody knows you're way too tough for him. Drop my stuff off, pick it up, strut back out. So I come strutting in one day halfway through the class, and he's not there. And there's this woman there, and she gives me a tardy slip. I'm like, you know, you don't understand who I am, you know. So I explained that to her, and she explained to me that she and Mr. Nelson had traded classes. Yeah, without even consulting me. And she didn't believe in students not coming to school, and she was not afraid of me. And she was my first immovable object. It was like meeting a sponsor in high school, you know. She just started on me, you know, and among other things, though, she also was very kind, and she really seemed to care about me. Most of the people in my life were saying, you're going to be dead by 18, you're not even worth messing with, and this woman was saying, you know, I think you're really smart. Nobody was saying I was smart. She said, I think you're smart, and I'd read all those books, you know. She said, I think you're smart, I think you could do something. Why don't you go? And she started, and she'd let me stay at her house sometimes, and she'd buy me food sometimes, and she was really amazing. And she said, but then she started getting to be a nag. So she tried to get me to take this test. So I'm like, why would I go take a test on purpose, you know? But, you know, a lot of times hers was the only class I'd go to. I'd cut all the rest of them. I'd just go for her class. And so she's nagging me about this stupid test. So I'm like, fine. So I took the test. So then she really became a nag. I said, look, here's where you scored. Here's where other people scored. You're really smart. You could go to college. I'm like, I'm not going to high school, you know. Seemed kind of relevant. But anyway, then she just kept that up. I come in. You know, why don't you go to college? I'm not going to college. I don't even know anybody ever went to college but you. Why don't you go to college? You could go to college. And finally, one day I walk in. You know, I like tradition. And I form traditions quickly. You do something with me a couple of times, it's how things are. I walk in, you say, why don't you go to college? I say, no. So I walk in one day, she doesn't say that. She said, you know, nobody here thinks you could make it in college, and they're probably right. I said, I could make it in college. So I went to college on a dare. I wasn't planning to stay, had no idea how to go, had no idea what to major in. Majored in English, because she was an English teacher. And I was just going to go a semester and show them. And I did not stop drinking. I did not start going to any classes before noon. I mean, I didn't, like, suddenly turn into a little Susan-y, student-y kind of person. But in spite of myself, I fell in love with learning. And I remember this, the moment it happened, and there was a second angel in my life. It was a woman who, she was a senior, and she would iron, which seemed odd to me, but she liked to iron her clothes. I'd actually not ever seen anybody do that. But anyway, her ironing board was attached to the wall, and she would iron. And so if she wanted to iron, she had to put up with me, and I didn't have any friends, so I'd go out there when she was ironing and kind of hang out with her. And we would talk about all these ideas that I had read these books about. And one day she said, you know, you've got a picture. It's not like two college students. It's like a college student and this, like, you know, kid with a cigarette hanging off my lip and, you know, rolled up in my sleeve. Anyway. Somebody came up to me while I was there and gave me a little button, said I'm a girl, and asked me to wear it. So I'm just saying that kind of a more accurate picture. But anyway, so we're out there. So one day she said, you know what? She said, you're really puzzling. She said, you never study, but you make really good grades. And she said, I think you're afraid to try. I said, I'm not afraid of nothing. I learned later that's not true, but I thought it was true until I got a sponsor. Anyway. She said, well, I don't think anybody else needs to know, but I think you do. She said, why don't you just pick one thing and secretly study and do your best and just see what happens. It's okay. I would do anything on a dare when I was a kid. And I did that, and I secretly studied this paper. It was on creativity. I can still see the cover of that paper. Because the most extraordinary thing happened to me when I started doing that. I found out that I had these pictures in my head. And I found out I could take these pictures, I could put words around them, I could put them up here like this, and I could make something brand new. I could make a whole new idea. And I thought, if that's what you do in college, I am staying. And I did. And I got in a lot of trouble over my drinking in college because things would happen to me. I've never been a person who could predict drinking. Once I take a drink, I don't know for sure what's going to happen. We just kind of go off to the races, and it never occurred to me to stop drinking, of course. But I would slip and slide out of things and somehow get away with stuff, and I just always had people who were willing to cover and help me out and work things out. And so one day at a time, I did that, and I didn't know how to be in college. I would just change my major every semester to whatever was interesting. You know, I'd take interesting stuff. I did so much of that that when I got ready to graduate, my advisor said she would not advise me because she'd never seen a transcript. I took Greek mythology. I just took all this stuff. But if you're really good at that and you like learning like that and you fall in love with it, eventually they make you graduate, which was really a scary idea to me. And so I went to graduate school. It's a direct result of my alcoholism. I have several degrees, including a doctorate. They call that a terminal degree. It means you're supposed to leave. And all during all of this going to college stuff, my drinking is getting worse and worse. It's creating some big, big problems. I started having blackouts. I didn't know they had a name for them until I came to AA. It just seemed like a time warp. It would be like I'm sitting in a bar in Tucson drinking, and it's like, click, my mind and body have separated. They get back together. We're in Tempe. I don't know how I got there. I'm in the middle of a conversation with some people I don't think I've ever seen before, and I don't know what we're talking about. And the first couple of times that happened, it was really frightening. I thought, my God, what's happening? I'm losing my mind. I don't know what this is. Now, I don't know about you, but I did not sit around in bars talking to people about that kind of stuff. You know, we just lie to each other. We don't say things like, you know what happened to me? I mean, I lost a couple hours. And just kind of try to catch up. And the first several times that happened, it was scary. And then it just became how things are. I adjust way too quickly to things. And I just think, oh, we're doing this now. Okay. I always did check to see if I still had my own clothing on. That seemed important to me. And when you wear glasses, it's tricky to come out of a blackout because you don't always have your glasses. They don't always make it with you. And I'm very nearsighted. So that was happening. And then things were getting trouble. And I would make promises. You know, that's it. I won't drink. I'm through. You're right. I'm never drinking whatever that was again. You know, I'm not drinking. And then I started, occasionally I would mistakenly eat something or drink the wrong thing and I would puke. And, you know, just as an aside, I want to tell you, I do not think we should have to puke sober. I just don't. I think we puked enough. We should never have to do that sober. I quit smoking. I should never have to cough. Anyway. The universe does not obey my rules. So anyway, so I would puke. And, you know, I would do weird things, like invite everybody to breakfast, which I, of course, didn't remember because it wasn't actually me inviting them to breakfast. It was my body, while my mind was elsewhere, occupied inviting them to breakfast. And they would come. You know, and I would cuss them all out and throw them out. And it's hard to have friends when you do that kind of stuff. And I couldn't go back to certain restaurants because I had puked on their tables. I mean, it was just, life was getting really kind of complex. And so I went to graduate school in Illinois. That seemed like it was far enough away, and they offered me money to go there, so I went there. Now, I had no idea how all this worked. So I had this car. Actually, it was a little convertible car, and the top blew off at some point, so I just left it there. So I'm driving with the little spines across. I just drilled holes in the floorboard so the water could get back out. I'm from Arizona. How often does it rain, right? Well, in Illinois, it rains a lot, I want you to know. And it snows, and it gets cold. And anyway, so I'm there, and I get there, and I find out it's 30 days before they're going to give me any money. I can't live. I went to the student loan office. I mistakenly thought they actually made loans. They don't. They tell you why you should have brought more money with you. I remember finally saying to the lady, you are acting as if I have money somewhere that I left just to annoy you. I have everything I can get my hands on I have with me right now, and it's not enough. And I finally got that loan. And it was the same way I used to feel when people would talk to me about my potential. You're not living up to your potential. I think, what do they think I have that I can't seem to put my hands on? You know, I don't know. Something that I left behind just to make them mad. I don't know. But anyway, so I'm doing this graduate school thing, and I start. And then in the last part of my graduate school, which is how I got to Texas, I went there to do my doctoral work. And at the end of that degree, things started getting really bad. And I started having these real unpredictable things that would happen. And the worst one of all from my point of view is that I would drink and sometimes I wouldn't get drunk. I would just I would be physically drunk but I was still present. I was still there. That thing I was talking about where it kind of goes, wow, that didn't happen. And it was awful. And I was it just seemed like inside, it was just cold and dark and awful. And I just wanted out. And I had tried to kill myself when I was a kid. Obviously, I wasn't successful at that. I just wanted out. I wanted off. I wanted out of here. I just wanted to be gone. And during that long period of my drinking, it was better, and now suddenly it was getting worse again. And I thought, I just need to get out of here. And at that time, there was another person in graduate school another student who thought that she knew what was wrong with me. She said, you know, God hates you because of your sexuality. And I said, okay. So I got married. Tell me you've thought longer than that about getting married, some of you. I know. So I married this guy, and I'd known him a few weeks. We were both in graduate school. I don't know why he married me anyway. So we got married, and I never really thought past getting married. You know, I never thought about, like, being married. I was never one for long-range planning. And so now there he is, and he was also the first person who was concerned about my drinking. And he would say stupid things like, why do you drink before you go to the party? Well, you can't put your life in their hands like that. You don't know how much they're going to have, how fast they're going to serve it. I mean, you cannot just throw yourself on their mercy. You know, you got to do a few things for yourself. So I never said that to him. I just explained things to him by saying things like, shut up. And then as a result of being an alcoholic one day at a time, being married to this guy, I ended up pregnant. It was never in my plan. Never in my plan to be pregnant. Never. I couldn't believe it. I thought, this cannot be happening to me, you know. And then I thought, well, because I'd studied psychology, so I thought it was probably one of those false pregnancies. Like, it's a hysterical pregnancy. I don't know why. I never thought about being pregnant. I don't know why I'd think I'm hysterically pregnant. But I thought, that must be it, you know. That's why psychologists are dangerous, because we believe all that stuff. Anyway, so, but it wasn't. It was an actual real human. And I thought, you know, God's getting me. This is God punishing me. I believed in God. I thought God hated me. And I thought, this is God getting me. And what's going to happen is there's going to be something wrong with that baby. And it's going to be my fault. I quit drinking. I quit smoking. I went on this women, infants, and children's nutrition thing. I mean, I did everything except eat liver, which I just couldn't do, but I did everything else. And I was crazy. And that's what I found out. You know, my ex-husband he was the only person who ever correctly diagnosed my problem. People my whole life had been saying things like, you know, the problem with you is you drink too much. And if you'd stop drinking, you'd be okay. And the problem with that is I never felt like I drank too much. Maybe you did. I never once said, wow, you know, that was too much. I drank too much. I should have stopped drinking earlier. You know, I never said that. And when I quit drinking, I'm not okay. I had experience with quitting drinking. When I quit drinking, I am nuts. When I quit drinking, I'm fine for a few minutes. And then I start getting a little antsy. And pretty soon I'm very antsy. Never feels like it's me. It's always you. The lights are too bright in here. That guy needs to not be sitting so close to that girl. That guy in the tank top, shave your back for crying out loud. You know, I'm just like, no! And then I take a drink. And he goes, huh. And I think, that's not a drinking problem. Well, so he's the first one that got it right. He said, because I'm not drinking, I'm not drinking because I'm not going to have something wrong with this baby. And he said, you have a non-drinking problem. He said, you are a lunatic when you're not drinking. Only one who got it right. And that baby was born, he brought me a bottle of hospital. He said, please drink this. So it was a gift, so I drank it. Anyway, I don't know how the nurses felt about that, but I got way more mellow. But anyway, I also was really terrified. I had been a violent person. I'd been from a violent family. I was afraid I was going to hurt that baby, but I was also afraid that I wouldn't care about him. I was drinking one time, and my dog got in the yard next door, and I loved that dog, but I was drinking, and the dog went over there, and he got killed, and I never went to see about him because I was busy. And I thought, that's how I'll be with this baby. I'll forget to take care of him. And I won't care about him. You know, I didn't care about anything. I was just dark and cold inside. I drank way past when I shouldn't have quit. And when that baby was born, one of the biggest surprises, it was like a laser beam of light coming through the darkness from his heart to mine. And I loved somebody for fun and for free for the first time in my life. And I did not want him to have somebody like me for a mother. And when I was little, I was so afraid that I would hurt him, that if he would do something and I would get upset. And I have to tell you, he was 6 when I got sober, and I did hurt him. I would raise my voice, he would run and get in the bathtub and cover his head. I never, ever wanted that for that little boy. I loved him more than my breath. And it turns out, as the book says, a good philosophy and a court of morals is not enough. And I just tried everything I could. And I would just, if I would get upset, I would just hand him to whoever's sitting by me. And I'd say, please take my baby. You know, I would just, I did not know what was wrong with me. If you had come up to me, if you'd followed me in a helicopter from when I was a kid, you would have thought I was an alcoholic. And if you had come up to me right then, looked me up to a lie detector and said, are you an alcoholic? I would have said no. And that needle would not have moved. I knew what an alcoholic was. An alcoholic is somebody who cannot quit drinking. And if they would just quit drinking, they'd be okay. And I told you, when I quit drinking, I'm a lunatic. So now I've got this kid. Now, clearly, getting married didn't work. Did not get God off my ass. So I got rid of the husband. Turns out you can't. If you have a kid together, you can't actually get rid of them. But I get him out of the picture. And I'm just trying to make it. And finally I thought, you know, it'd be better for me and him and everybody else if I just kill myself. And I started putting things in place for that to happen. Now I was doing some outside issues, so I had some voices in my head that were communicating with me. I thought that was God. If you're new, I'll just save you a little trouble. God is not speaking to you from the heater vent. And I'll tell you how to recognize God's voice. It'll sound a lot like your sponsor's voice. And, you know, Clancy says my sponsor's not God, but it is God's official representative on earth where I'm concerned. And I have found that it's a much better idea for me to go with their ideas than my ideas. But I wasn't in AA, so I didn't know all of that. So I'm thinking this is God, and me and God have a deal. If I try everything that is suggested to me and prove it doesn't work, God will let me die. And this whole series of events happened, and I can't tell you the order in which they happened because I just don't know. I got a job at a university because they had insurance, and I would take care of my son when I died. I got this woman to leave her husband and move in with me so that she would take care of him. I put it in my will so she'd feel guilty if she didn't do it. I have to tell you, it was over 10 years before she'd accept my amends. But anyway, And during this time, all of a sudden, this woman talked to me about ACA. I'd never heard of that, had no idea what it was, didn't care what it was. She said, you really ought to go to that. I'm like, fine, I'll go to that, check that off the list. Went to that. I was not the kind of newcomer people come up to. I was there, like, you know, glaring at all the people. And after that, this woman came up and gave me a tape. Now, I recently ran into that person again that gave me that tape, and I asked her, I said, why did you give me that tape? She said, there's something about you reminded me of this person. I don't know what an AA tape is. I don't know why. I don't know this woman. I don't know why she gave me this tape. I'm not listening to the tape. I do contempt prior to investigation. If I don't know what it is, I don't like it. So I get in my car, and I think, wonder why she gave me that tape. Wonder who that person is. Wonder what an AA tape is. Wonder why she gave me that tape. Wonder what's on that tape. And then this other guy starts thinking, who cares? I'm not listening to that tape. It's some like lecture on alcoholism, or it's a little mantra like, don't drink, don't drink, don't drink. I'm not listening to that. I don't care. I don't need to listen to that. I'm not listening to that. Yeah, but I wonder what's on that tape. Well, I don't know, but I don't care. I'm not listening to that. Pretty soon I just put the tape in just to shut them all up. And it was a tape of Junji. I listened to that tape. And I couldn't believe it. It was like she was in my head. I mean, here was this person who had a lot of the weird things that I had. She'd had a way worse life than mine. She'd been way tougher than me. And she'd gone to college, and she had that same feeling I always had about it was like somebody was going to come any minute and find out I was there and tell me I needed to leave. And she talked about that. I mean, I had never heard anything like that. She was just like me at the end of that tape. She said she went to AA, and I'm thinking, that can't be it. That cannot be it. I cannot be an alcoholic. And then she said, it was a tape she made from in Crested Butte. She talked about being in Seattle at the conference and wearing this green dress and feeling like she wanted to be wearing the dress she was wearing, and she wanted to feel the way she felt, she wanted to be who she was, and I thought, that will never happen for me. But if that's what's wrong with her, and she's the only person I've ever heard who's just like me, maybe that's it. I mean, it just can't be, but maybe it is. And I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's important to me to tell you that from that first meeting, with a bad attitude and absolutely no intention of getting help or staying, I've been kept sober in Alcoholics Anonymous since that day, continuously. But not right away. I mean, I went in there, people used to scatter when I would walk in the room. And I liked that. I was 9 months sober. This woman came up to me and she said, "You know, I didn't think you liked me when you were first here." And I said, "Well, were you breathing?" You know, that was pretty much my criteria. I wasn't really picky, you know. I did not want to be there. I'm really grateful we didn't have online meetings. I never would have walked in the building, and I probably never would have gotten sober. And I started the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was not newcomer of the year. I had this cowboy hat pulled down over my face, and I'd sit in the meetings and glare at everybody, and I'd hear about every 14th word and not know what was going on and try and make sure you knew I did not need your help. After a couple of weeks of that, I ended up back in a bar, and I didn't drink only because the person I was with was so delighted that I was, just as I started to lift the drink to my mouth, she had this just I win look on her face, and I'm like, you know, so I left, and went back to the meeting. I was kind of like, what was that you were saying about, you know, getting help, and this person, people had been giving me their numbers, and I wouldn't actually take them. I wanted him to know I'm not, you know, doing that. But this night I really wanted some help, and there was a woman in there who was talking, and she was talking about how she wasn't going to get a sponsor early on. She didn't want a sponsor. We were going to have a sponsor. People would give her their numbers. She'd pay no attention. I thought, that's the woman for me. I'm going to call her. And so I went up, and I said, could I have your number? And she wouldn't even write it down. She just said it like I wasn't worth bothering with. So I figured she had good sense, so I called her. And I'll tell you, you know, she didn't get to stay sober, and she had really a crummy program, but she was enough for me for a while. She wouldn't talk to me at the meeting. She'd kind of play like she didn't know me, and then she'd talk to me later. But it didn't matter. It was okay. You know, and I'd go in that meeting, and I'd try and chase people off and try and make sure they didn't come anywhere near me. And there were a couple of people who did. One of them is Diane. That began my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's been an amazing adventure. It's hard for me to think about how that was at that time, because it's like I live a different life on a different planet. I had some important things that happened on the journey. Among other things, I had a funny experience with my first four step. I couldn't read the book. I mean, I could read the book, but I couldn't, the words wouldn't make sense. They would just, I could say them, but then at the end, I wasn't really sure I was still on the same sentence, and I had no idea what it meant, which was terrifying. I mean, I told you I had that thing about reading and thinking, and all of a sudden I couldn't do that. So now I can't drink, and I can't do that reading thing, and I can't be sober, and I'm just nuts. I remember I'd call her up and I'd say, I can't sleep. I need sleeping pills. She'd say, oh, nobody ever died of lack of sleep. And I'd think, I'm going to, and then I'm going to show you. And it made me feel better, you know. I always overlooked the fact that I'd be dead. But anyway, so I kind of I limped along for a while. And then I had the step Nazi for a period of time as a sponsor. And she would, no matter what you said to her, she'd say, write an inventory on that. So I ended up doing my first inventory in a whole series of inventories. I did inventories on violence, for crying out loud. That's not in the big book. I did, every time I opened my mouth, I seemed to be doing another inventory. And little by little by little, it's like she started scraping away pieces of me that were in the way.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
When I was 3.5 years sober, this scary thing happened to me in AA, because by now I'm thinking this is working. I haven't had a drink. I would wake up in the morning and go, wow, I have not had a drink. It was amazing to me. I'd never been able to do that. And so I'm thinking, this is really working, you know, and all of a sudden it seemed like it wasn't anymore. It felt like AA was like everything else. It just works for a while and then it runs out. It worked longer than most things, but it was not working. And it was like I was going back to sleep inside. I was getting cold and dead and dark inside again. And it really scared me, and I didn't know what to do. And I did what we all do. I did more of what I was already doing, going to more meetings, doing more stuff, thinking more about what is it, what's wrong. I got to figure this out. You know, figuring it out is really, oh, there's a good plan. Think about yourself. Anyway, and finally I thought, well, this just doesn't work, and I just need to get out of here. I just need to go back to my original plan. And I walked out in the parking lot, and my former sponsor, the Step Nazi, was out there, and she said, I'm tired of watching you die. What's the matter with you? And I said, AA doesn't work. Actually, I had called somebody. I actually had reached out to somebody. I called this woman, and I told her the truth. I said, it just seems like AA's not working anymore. And she said, you know what? She said, you have deep psychological problems, and you're way too screwed up for AA. You need something more advanced. You need to go to therapy. It was like a door slamming. Because what I knew is, if you guys can't help me, nobody can. And I just, that's when I went to that one more meeting. I hope if you're new, you'll always go to one more meeting. I wasn't any better at the end of that meeting. I walked past my Step Nazi sponsor. She said, I'm tired of watching you die. What is the matter with you? And I said, AA doesn't work for people like me. I have deep psychological problems. I'm too screwed up. And I'm going to go home and kill myself. She said, fine, but before you do, why don't you call June and ask her if AA's enough? I'm like, fine. So, I don't know June. I've never met June. But I called her. I got her number from the taper, and I called her up. And, you know, it was magic. It was like, and I know she does a lot of stuff in AA. She's got a job. She had a lot of things going on. And she talked to me like she didn't have one thing to do. And she said, she started off by saying, if you're going to kill yourself, I'm going to hang up. But if you promise not to kill yourself, I'll talk to you and share my experience, strength, and hope. And she told me a story about a pony and a bunch of other stuff. And at the end, it was a cool story, but I don't need to tell it. But anyway, at the end of our conversation, she said, I'm going to tell you something. She said, you think you have deep psychological problems. You don't. She said, you just have one problem. You're selfish and self-centered, and you seem to have a really bad case of it. Yeah, I don't think they have that in the suicide prevention manual, June. And then she did what we do in AA. She told me what to do about that. She said, go to the nursing home, visit somebody whether you know them or not. Go to the hospital, visit somebody whether you know them or not. Go to the meeting. Instead of listening for what you can get, listen for what you can give. And she said, I want you to do nothing but see what you can do to add to the lives of other people and then call me back in 3.5 days. Now, I wrote all that down because that was the lamest thing I had ever heard. And I started doing those things. Now, I have to tell you, it took me a while to even think of anything. So I was maybe a little bit into self-centeredness. And I remember that Sunday I went to a meeting, and at that meeting, I would go early, because if you go early and you're already sitting at the table, and then the old timers come in, they don't make you leave, and then you can hang out and listen to them. And so that's what I would do every Sunday. And so sure enough, this Sunday, here they all come, and this one lady, this had been sober forever, and they were talking, and one of them said, where's Grapevine Mary? And this other one said, oh, she's at her nursing home. I nearly knocked the table over trying to figure out where she, where? I need somebody in a nursing home. So they tell me where it was. And then I go, how does a nursing home work? I have no idea how to go. You know, can you like just walk in the door? How do you do that? And Mo, again, magic. She goes, I'll take you. Took me in the nursing home. Mary was perfect for somebody like me because she had some form of dementia. 5 minutes after you're there, she can't remember you've been there. So you can go back all day long. Every time you need to, you just go back over, and she go, oh, you never come see me. Now, if I have to do that and I sponsor you, you have to do that. So we had a whole lot of people going over to see Mary, and they, you know, it was just very cool. And we ended up giving her chip, and we just did all kinds of stuff with her. I did all that stuff that June told me to do, and after 3.5 days, I was better than I'd ever been in my life. And it turns out, selfishness and self-centeredness doesn't feel the way I thought it did. I thought the way it felt was people sitting around going, aren't I great? I'm so cool. I'm so great. Not me. I'd wake up in the morning and go, you dumb shit. You shouldn't. Oh, sorry. You shouldn't even be allowed to suck air. What's the matter with you? You're a slime. God, I can't believe you just did that. You know, I mean, just like that all day long. And June explained to me, she said, self-centeredness doesn't mean you think well of yourself. It doesn't even mean you think of yourself often. It means that's all you think about. And even if you're thinking crummy stuff, you're still thinking about you. And after 3.5 days, I was better than I'd ever been. And I called June and asked her to be my sponsor, and she agreed to do that. And I spent about 3 years being afraid that if I tell her this, she's going to tell me to take a hike. And she never did. It was like having somebody who just can nudge you back to the center of the road. I mean, it was extraordinary. I would call her. And there were some things that I found incredibly embarrassing that I had to tell her. And she never once said, that's stupid. And just as a dumb example, I had, this was not, you know, I'm not going to tell you the worst stuff, but I'll just tell you this. I had been sober a while, and I had people I sponsor, and they were all in my backyard, and one of them was a shoe salesman, and she looks at me one day, and she goes, you wear the wrong size shoes. I'm mortified. I have a PhD. I'm not going to tell June I don't know how to pick out shoes. Now, the fact is, I don't know how to pick out shoes. I would just go in the shoe store and get some. You know, I mean, I grew up wearing the shoes that come in the box from the church, where you just get whichever ones you can and you wear them. You know, I just never thought about it. Some of them hurt and some of them had trouble staying on. You just wear shoes, you know. So I don't know how to get shoes. I just go in the store and I just get some. And because I like to get out of the store as fast as I can because I don't know what I'm doing and it feels bad. So she, but I don't want to tell June I don't know how to pick out shoes. So I'm going to wait. You know, I always like to wait. And finally, I called her because I know she's going to say, don't ever call me again. And I called her and I told her what happened. And she said, how would you know? They have a class in graduate school on picking out shoes? No. Okay, so you sponsor a shoe salesman. Tell her to teach you how to pick out shoes. Now, she was a men's shoe salesman, but I didn't know there was a difference. So I wore men's shoes that year. And I tell you, I've said that so many times to people I sponsor, saying, well, this, how would you know? How would you know? When I was about, I guess it was about 9 years sober, I was when I was 7 years sober, my son's husband died. And I was supposed to go to Indian Wells to talk at Shirley's, wherever she is, powwow, or the whatever that was at Indian Wells. Anyway, so here's my son, and his dad just died, and I'm supposed to go to this thing, and I don't know what to do. And this guy offered me a ticket, but of course I turn him down because I don't take stuff from people. And then I talked to June, and she said, the guy offered you a ticket. You know, take it. Oh. And anyway, June at that time was out of the country. My husband's father died. I don't know what to do. And I go to this conference. I'm waiting for June to get back because I only trust her and she's the only one I talk to. Now, she's going to be gone for a while. She's in another country, but I'm waiting. And I'm nuts, as you can imagine. And I get to this conference, and on the way there, the guy is trying to impress me. So he's telling me how rich everybody is and how, you know, we're driving by lawns that look like somebody manicured them by hand. And this long driveway up to this hotel, and you get to the hotel, and they have, like, you flick an ash, and they come and clean it, and there's a rug in the elevator that has the day of the week, and I'm thinking, this is not good. And we're in the elevator, and a guy gets on with a badge that says security, so I got off, and then I realized you invited me there, you're not looking for me, and I'm just like, whoa, all over the place. And I think, I gotta go. I cannot be here. I gotta go. And but I had agreed to meet Sharon there, so she called me, and she said, oh, hi, you know, can't wait. I was supposed to speak Friday night. She said, I can't wait to see you. Come on down. And I'm like, I'm not staying. I'm leaving. She said, okay, all right, okay. I understand how you might leave. But, you know, you came all this ways, and I'd love to see you. But everybody down here is dressed up, so go ahead and put on your speaker stuff and come on down. So, you know, okay. And I go down there. And she goes, well, let's just talk. And she starts talking, and I don't even know I need to talk about anything. All of a sudden, I'm just like, blah, 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 blah. My son's father dying, and blah, 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 and all this stuff. And because he died just suddenly. And she said, you know what? She said, I don't ever want you to wait for June to come back. So from now on, if you don't call her and you don't talk with her in any week, you call me, and I'm going to be your backup person. And I called Sharon as my backup person when I couldn't get June. And she was very gracious about that. Let's see, I'm sort of wandering around. When I was 9 years sober, this thing started happening. It was like I'd drive by this billboard. The billboard said, depressed. And I'd think, yes, now that you mention it, I think I am depressed. And then a little ways further, there was another that had a little shot glass, and it said, at the end of a long day. I think, I've had a long day. And I thought, God, what are you doing? You're thinking about drinking. I thought, no, I'm not thinking about drinking. I'm just, you know, noticing the billboards. And so I'm not taking that really very seriously. And I think, oh, people, you know, they have these little superstitions in AA, like 9 years is a really hard year. Okay, so it's probably just that. This is probably what they're talking about. And I went up to Crested View Conference that I go to every year, and I like to wait. You know, I like to jump right into talking to my sponsor. So I'm up there. We're on vacation. We're having our annual fight, which we always saved for vacation. And things aren't going very well, and I'm having all kinds of trouble. And I went fishing, and, I guess that wasn't the first thing, was we went rafting. And I got pitched out of the boat, and I'm furious. I am so mad. I get back in that boat, and I plant my foot, and I go, I am, by God, not doing that again. 30 seconds later, I'm flying through the air again. And now I'm seeing red. I mean, I'm so mad they won't even let me back in the boat. They just got a little oar and dragged me over to a rock. And the guide said, you sit on that rock till you calm down enough to get back in this boat. And now I'm humiliated and mad. So that gets over with. Then the next day we go fishing. I like to fish. I like to catch fish. And they have a big lake trout. I mean, this is fun. So we're out there in this little boat. And I get a strike. And it's like a big one. You can feel it. And I'm like, gets within a few feet of the boat, that fish goes, bah, and spits out the hook. Mama, are you kidding me? Gets about that far from the boat, spits it out again. I'm like, no, four times he did that, four times. Fourth time, I grabbed an oar, I stood up, and I said, I'm going to find that effing fish and club it to death. And then I noticed the other people in the boat are going, and I'm like, So I tried to play like I was kidding. Yeah, did not work. Nobody's buying that. Nobody's talking to me now. Nobody's talking to me. Now I call my sponsor. And I told her what was happening. And it was a phone booth. For those of you who are young, we used to have our phones actually on a wall in a little thing. A little room you'd go into. It's a very archaic idea, but we had one of those in Crested View. I'm in there, and I called June, and I told her what had been going on. I told her about those billboards, and I told her about the fishing, and I told her about the raft, and I told her all what was going wrong and how nobody was treating me right. And she said, you know what? When I was where you are, I was closer to drinking than I've been, and I think it was 26 years at the time. And I slid down that wall. I couldn't believe it. I cannot go back to where I was. I cannot. I will do anything not to go back to where I was. And I said, what do I do? And she said, well, she said, you know, you're going to have to make a decision. You can be sober and drunk. I mean, sober and vulnerable, or tough and drunk. I'm like, what's another choice? What else could we do? And she's like, that's it. And she told me, she said, you know, there are more people who know that I care about them today than I've ever known before, and I've been hurt less than I've ever been hurt. And that just didn't sound right. You know, my deal is I read your mind and I get you before you get me. That's kind of my way of being in the world. She said, go be with your people. You're at a conference. Go be with your people and cry. I'm like, don't cry. Give me a break. You know. So I have to find. I can't go back where I was. That's what I got to do. Fine, I'll shed a tear. So I go to this meeting. I go to the meeting. I don't cry. Cool. Okay. Go to the meeting that night, speaker meeting. Sharon is the speaker. And I'm up here like these guys are. And I don't know about you, but I lose track of the fact that we never have a speaker whose story ends with, and I'm still drinking. You know, I mean. But I get caught up in Sharon's story, and I think, God, I hope she makes it. And just about that time, tears come up in my eyes, and I'm thinking, no, 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 not now. I mean, these are 600 people in the room and my toughest friend sitting right there. This is a bad idea. And thankfully, I've read the big book a lot, and I could hear rebellion dogs are every step. And I thought, fine. So I said, now, you know, it felt to me like I was crying. Probably three tears came down my face, but it was enough for me to think, you know, maybe I should never go to that conference again. And nobody noticed, nobody cared. My tough friend didn't notice, didn't care. You know, it was fine. And I began to pay attention to that. I began to little by little put some of that down. And I'll tell you, you know, the funny thing is there's a couple of things that are interesting to me. One is that I would like to be who I am today. I would like to have the job I have. I would like to live in the house I live in. I would like to feel the way I feel. I never thought that would happen. That's what June said happened to her. I never thought it would happen to me. And it has happened. And there are more people in my life who know I care about them than have ever known before. And I've been hurt less than I've ever been hurt since that day. I mean, who knew? It turns out that's true, even for me. And I have people, you know, I mean, I have students who know that I care about them. I have all sorts of people in my life that know I care about them. And they don't hurt me with it. My son is 30 years old, and he lives in Dallas. And it took a long time. I had to make a lot of amends to him. And it was a gradual process of us becoming okay. I did not know how to be a mother. I did the best I could. I used to stand on the schoolyard and watch the other mothers and try to figure out what to do. You know, they make cookies, I go and make cookies, you know. And finally, one day, I realized that I can't be them. I'm not them. I got to be who I am. And somebody told me, they said, you know, if God had wanted him to have one of those people for a mother, he'd be their kid. He must mean for you to be their mother. And I thought, okay, so if I'm supposed to be his mother, what have I got? Well, I know a lot about universities and books, and I'd already helped him with that. I would take him out. We'd look for frogs. We did all sorts of stuff. And I thought, I know how to sponsor people. I've sponsored people. I'm a good sponsor. I've had sponsors, and I'm a good sponsor. So I said, Matt, I'm firing myself as your mother. I'm signing on as your sponsor. He said, okay, what does that mean? I said, that means if you have something going on in your life and I have some experience, I said, you can be really smart, but that doesn't make up for no experience. So if you have something going on in your life and you don't have any experience, if I do, I'll share my experience with you. If I don't, we'll find somebody who does and we'll get them to share their experience. And after you've heard their experience, you can decide what you want to do. And I said, and it means I absolutely love you no matter what you do, and I want only what is good for you, and I ask you nothing in return. He said, that sounds good. And then I'm dying because he's not asking me anything, you know? I got a list of stuff he should be asking me about. You know, it's funny because he's trying to look into colleges, and I know colleges. I've spent my life at colleges, but he's not asking me until after that. And then he did. And I'll back up a little bit earlier than that. I had, it was like there was plexiglass between me and him. You know, I didn't want him to find out about my life. I was trying actually for him not to know. I'm like, you know, I have this house with this lawn that I mow, and I'm trying to pretend I'm somebody else. And I ended up having to talk to him about my life, and I thought he would hate me. I mean, I thought he would hate me. And he didn't. You know, what he said was, you know what? He said, I knew there had to be more to your life than I knew about, or why would they keep asking you to go talk in the AA meetings? And that was when I realized what I needed to make amends to him about. I'd let him out of my life. That what he knew was I would come here to Los Angeles and talk, or Torrance or wherever we are, and I would talk to South Bay. I know that. I would come here and I would tell you about my life and I wouldn't tell him. That's what he knew. He didn't hate me for the life I had had like I did. I have recently, I guess I have a little bit more time. I'll tell you about my mother because this was a long journey for me. My mother, when she married that alcoholic, it was all then about him. And he was sexually abusive and she didn't care. And and he would beat us up, and she didn't care. It was just hard. So when I got old enough to get out of there, I did, and I just kind of cut it all off. And when I got sober, my sponsor said, you need to tell your mother where you live. And I'm like, why? You know, she didn't need to know that. I mean, I divorced them, you know. And she said, well, you know, you just need to let her know where you are. And I'm like, that's a bad idea. But, okay, fine. Her answer to me always was, okay, drink. I'm like, okay, fine. All right, what do you want me to do? Okay. So I wrote her this letter, told her where I lived. Several months later, I get this letter, her return address. I totally freaked out. I called her. I said, I told you that was a bad idea. She said, what happened? I said, I have a letter from her. She said, what does it say? I said, I don't know. I'm not reading it. She said, you have a letter. You're freaked out. You haven't even opened it. Perhaps you owe her amends. I said, no, she wasn't on my amends list. Don't say that to your sponsor. Oh, let's do an inventory on your mother. A whole inventory on my mother. Now, I don't know about you. I love the first two columns. Yeah, I do. I am into the first two columns. I like that. I mean, it's just sad. You'd drink too, you know. I mean, it's just terrible. Oh, she killed my dog, you know. I'm not fond of the rest of the process, but I love those for two columns. So enjoy those while you can. They'll kill you, but they're fun. And then, so anyway, then I had to go read her this inventory. And I thought, you know, I was almost looking forward to that because there were some terrible things that happened. And I told her all this stuff, and she just looked at me, and she said, wow, all of that happened a long time ago. You've never checked back to see if maybe she's changed. And I never had. I had her frozen in time from that day. So I had to start corresponding with my mother. I had to send her a card at Christmas and her birthday and Mother's Day, and it had to be a card she would like. And so I did that. And then at some point after June became my sponsor, and I don't remember how this happened, but there's some occasion for this, and she suggested that I needed to write something in the cards. I figure, why compete with Hallmark? You know, they know what they're doing. But anyway, she suggested I needed to tell her something. Where do you start with that, you know? And here's what she said. She said, I want you to tell her something that you are grateful for. And she said, it doesn't even have to have turned out well in the end. So she said, let's say she takes you to the beach, she gets drunk, she gets arrested, you go to foster care, you give her credit for she takes you to the beach. Now, that's a pretty big hoop, right? Took me 3.5 days to think of something that she did that met that criteria. And what I realized, so I was sitting in my kitchen one day, I was petting a cat, because I always had cats, and I thought, I love cats. I've always had cats. My mother had cats. I'm going to thank her for having cats. And this other guy wakes up in my head and goes, that is the dumbest thing. Most people who know me would say that's maybe not even the top 10. But and I could hear this other guy going, rebellion, dogs are every step. And I could hear my first sponsor going, okay, fine, drink. I'm like, okay, fine, I'll write the letter. So I write her this whole letter about cats, you know. So I don't hear back from her. Long time later, like months later, this box arrives. A little box, and I open up the box. Not a word, but there's a cat bookmark, a little cat statues, all this little cat stuff in there from her. And so I started talking with some more. And then we were going to Arizona, and June had suggested, she had told me about thank you amends, which is, it's not like you harmed them, but there were people who added to your life. And there were some people in Arizona who definitely had done that, including these professors and stuff. And so I was going to go out there and see them. And I stopped to see my mother. I gave her a computer and did some stuff with her then. And then now she's got a computer. So now she can send stuff. So I send her jokes, and she'd send them out to all her friends. And she became the joke lady. And she got a lot of juice for these jokes. And you know, we never really did have a relationship. I mean, it was kind of not much to it. And I remember I'd hear people and they'd say, well, you know, and then I made amends to my mother and we became best friends and we shared our heart and we talked and we made cookies. And I'd call June and I go, June, I don't think I made that amends right. She'd go, why? I go, well, because that's not happening with us. She said, it's not about her. It's about you. She just doesn't have a program. She's not going to change. It's about you being different. You just keep being a good daughter. And then later when Sharon became my sponsor, she's just like, you just be a good daughter. You just show up and be a good daughter. So I had to go out at one point and find out from people what good daughters do. And I'd ask people, what's a good daughter do? And they'd tell me little stuff to do. And I would do that stuff. And then I got a phone call one day that said she was sick. She was in hospital. And so I thought, well, maybe I ought to go out there. And I thought, well, maybe not. Finally, I thought, well, I think a good daughter would go. Because I would call her and I'd say, I'm coming. And she'd go, I don't want you here. And I'd think, well, okay, you know, maybe I should go. Finally, I thought, well, I'm just going to go. So I went out there, and it was really hard. It was very hard. I had not been back to the place where I grew up. She wasn't living in that house, but in that area. I had not, there was just a lot of stuff there. I thought I had to spend all my time there with her at the hospital. I, of course, didn't ask June 1st how to go to a hospital. I just went. And after a couple of days, and my mother would do things, like the social worker came in, and as I was walking out, the social worker said, is that your daughter? And she said, no, I don't have a daughter. You know, so there was just little stuff like that. And I'm driving down the street, and it's hot. It's Arizona, it's hot. And I thought, you know, I just need to go in a bar. I mean, not to drink. I just need to go, you know, I just need to be somewhere cool, where there's music and, you know, people understand me. You know, we can lie like crazy to ourselves when we're just lying in our head. And all of a sudden that, I'm so glad I read the big book, and I hope you do too, because that little part from the big book came back to me about Bill Wilson stepping into the Mayflower Hotel. And I thought, that's like right out of the book. And I called June and she said, come back, go home. And I did. And the next time I went, I talked to her first, and she told me how to go. And I did it her way, and it went better. And by the end of that time, then my mother asked me to be executor of her will, which I did. And I have power of attorney because I'm the only one in my family who's in AA. And I made my amends to her, and she started getting better, actually. And so I ended up getting her a little apartment and doing all this stuff. And then about 5 years later, I got another call. I said, you know, she went to hospice, but she got well. So she thought you go to hospice, you get well. But anyway, so they had her back in hospice again. They said this time she's not going to get well. And so I called her. I said, I'm going to come. She said, I don't want you to come yet. This time she said, I don't want you to come yet. And so finally I went out there and I did all the things she liked to do. I took her to all her favorite restaurants. I took her to the ball game. And nobody would take her. She loves ball games. They have spring training in Arizona, so she loved it. Nobody would take her because they didn't want to haul her into the wheelchair and all that. I took her to all, but they go, what if she dies at the ball game? I go, she's going to die somewhere. Might as well die doing something she likes, you know. Might be hard for the people around her, but for her, you know, she'll be all right. And I did all that stuff for that weekend and took her to see people she knew. And at the end of that weekend, I left her with a book I'd been reading because she didn't have a book, and I went home. And the next morning, they called and said she'd read half of that book, put her head back, and died. And it was weird, you know. It's like, no, I was just there, you know. And they said, so, you know, sometimes they just save the best thing. They just save something, and then when that's done, they go, it's not going to get any better than this, and they just go. And that's what she did. And when I went to her funeral, the priest, who I now knew because I kept seeing him at the hospital, so was her favorite priest, and he was there. And he said, you know, she's free. Now you be free. And then he said, you know, you're a good daughter. He said, in fact, you're an example of what a good daughter ought to be. You know, and I wanted him to call my sponsor because that was all she ever said was be a good daughter. And I'm like, I want a certificate or something, you know, because he's saying I'm a good daughter. And the other thing that happened at that funeral that was kind of cool was that I had heard people talk about emotional sobriety. I had no idea what they're talking about. And I was pretty sure if it meant I had to get my emotions under control, I was really screwed, because I don't even know what they are. They just kind of, whoa, you know. And so at that funeral, this weird thing happened. It happened twice. One of them was my stepsister. And I have a stepsister. She's the only person who didn't drink. She married an alcoholic, married a gambler, but she never drank. She was sober through the whole thing. And she would be in the kitchen making a cake from scratch going, I do not live in this family. And so I called and said, you know, they said if you want to see her, you need to come now. And she's like, well, is she going to die this time? Because they told me that once before, and she didn't die. I said, I don't know. She hasn't made any promises. I'm just telling you what they said, you know. So at the funeral, she doesn't come to the funeral. So I'm thinking, there's this group of people talking about her. You know how people are. They're over there going, I can't believe she can come to her own mother's funeral. And I thought, I'm going to go join them because now I'm the good one for the first time in my life. You know, yeah, why isn't she here? But one of the things you taught me was step 10. You taught me to pause. And the pause allows me to hear a softer, quieter voice that said, if it wasn't for AA, you wouldn't be here. Maybe what you ought to do is try and see what you can do to add to her life. And so I turned around, went the other way, called her, said, what can I do for you? I understand why you're not here. And she told me some stuff, and I did that stuff. And so when I got back, I called Sharon, and I said, this weird thing happened. This is what happened. And she said, well, that's emotional sobriety. She said, emotional sobriety is, given a choice, you take the spiritual high road. And that pause is what gave me the choice. I'm like, oh, okay. And I tell you, the last couple of years have really been, I don't want to learn to be with people who are sick and dying, but that's what it's been. And I remember I had a week where it seemed like a whole lot of our AA old-timers got sick and died, right, all at once. And then another friend of mine had active AIDS. And it was just like, I was doing okay till the last one, and it just kind of put me over an edge. And I called June, and I said, this is what's going on. And she said, well, you know, she said, you can focus on the gift or you can focus on the loss. And I think your day will go better if you focus on the gift. She said, you have no right to have those people in your life. If it wasn't for AA, you wouldn't have ever had them in your life. And then she said, you know, spend all your time with them that you can. And I did that. And one of them was a guy named Buddy. And Buddy had, he was just this guy that I had been really close to. Started off because I was making amends to my stepfather that I tried to kill by being nice to men in the meeting. And Buddy just was this nice guy, and he was sick. And my normal thing would be, you're sick, I'm out of here. But I spent all the time I could with him. And he did die. And it was sad, but it wasn't nearly as sad as wondering what I missed by not being with him. And then I watched Sharon go through Casey's death and do that in such an extraordinary way, both of them. And now I have a good friend of mine. I did a book a little while back about the Sisters of St. Mary, and one of those sisters I got really, really close to. She's a wise woman, just an amazing woman. And she is living out the end of her life. They don't think she's going to make it till August. And because of those experiences I had in AA, I go over there twice a week. And one of the days I play Scrabble with her. And the other day I just go and sit and talk with her until she's tired, and then I leave. You taught me how to be with people who are sick and people who are living out the end of their life. And it's allowed me to be a better friend and to be a better person. My son is an incredible human being. He's an amazing kid. I remember one time at Crested Butte, he talked about the Alateen kids up there, and he said, but you know, Mom, we all come from good families. And I thought, wow, he thinks he came from a good family. And he went to Alateen. He went to Alateen because they had girls. You guys don't seem to care. You'll take them, however they come. And I liked that up until the point where he started saying things like, I don't have to accept unacceptable behavior. I'm like, you don't go there anymore, you know. When I was newly sober, my sponsor made me sign a 6-month lease, which I thought was outrageous. And today I live in a house that I've lived in for over 20 years, and that house is paid for. Turns out if you make all your financial amends and then you like save money and stuff and keep working at the same job, you can actually do stuff like that. I had no idea. I've never known anybody who had a house, much less a paid. Now, it's not like an L.A. house. It's a Fort Worth house. They're not. We don't have millions of dollars in houses. But I've been in the same relationship with the same person for 20 years. I'm in the same home group where I first got sober. I have deep, close friendships. I've realized today that I've known June. She's been an instrument in my life for over half of her sobriety, which I find extraordinary. I have people that I know I can call, and they will help me. And I have a God of my own understanding, not the hitman God I had when I got sober. It turned out I had to get rid of that God. It turned out part of my understanding of God came from hallucinations. I didn't think I had hallucinations. I just had what I thought were spiritual experiences. They were really terrifying, and I wanted nothing to do with them. And it turns out that's not a spiritual experience. I finally talked to somebody about it one day, and she was like, that is not a spiritual experience. And so you allowed me to start over. When I was in Ireland, they talked about these places that they called thin places. And they were talking about a particular geographic location, but it was a place where they felt you could be closer to God in these places. And I don't want to discuss with you whether that's true or not after the meeting, but I do want to say that idea helped me to understand what happened to me in AA. What happened in AA was you created a thin place in my soul. You created a spot in me where I could experience the God who's always been there and has always been a part of my life. But there was just so much of me in the way that I couldn't ever experience it. I would trade anything for that. I would go back and go through every awful thing that I have had happen in my life to have that. It is that priceless to me. It's the thing that gives me a sense of peace. You know, when my sponsor found out about how I had lived as a kid, and she said, weren't you afraid to be in those fights? Because, I mean, I have, like, some teeth knocked out and a broken arm and some stuff. And she said, why weren't you afraid? I said, I didn't know. I couldn't answer that question. And I realized later, it was because I felt so bad inside that it didn't matter what you did to me on the outside. Go ahead, you want to hit me, whatever you want to do. And what I realized today is what I have on the inside is so good that it doesn't matter what happens to me on the outside. I have some nice stuff. I have a nice job, a nice family, a nice house, but it doesn't matter. And I'll end with this. I had, when I was a kid, I used to walk down the street, especially on holidays, and I'd look in other people's windows and imagine what it was like to be them. And there was a family that lived down the street from me, and they lived in a tent. It was a big tent, and it was a big family, and they'd always have the flaps up because it was hot. And I could see them in there, and they had a lantern. They'd be playing games. They'd be talking. They'd be eating. And I think, I wish I lived there. I wish I could live there. And I would think about how neat it would be to be there. And if you were a kid and you walked down the street any day of the week and you looked in my front window, you'd want to live in my house. You'd wish you could live there. And I'm really grateful that I do. Thank you.
Enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.